From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, the Great Vaccine Special. Here's what's happening. Very sad and tragic news tonight. Veteran CBS 60 Minutes correspondent Bob Simon, who for more than four decades has been one of America's most respected journalists, killed in a accident Wednesday evening when his driver lost control and crashed on the West Side Highway in Manhattan. The Lincoln Town car in which Simon, he was 73 years old, was riding, collided with a Mercedes-Benz, then veered across the roadway, plowed into a pedestrian expansion. The driver of the Mercedes said that the car was swaying erratically before the crash. Bob Simon, dead at the age of 73. President Barack Obama has said Islamic State militants will lose as he asks Congress now to formally authorize military force against them. He warned against dragging the U.S. into another prolonged ground war and called on lawmakers to show a united front. The United States has carried out airstrikes against ISIS since last year in a coalition with other nations. It's the first time that a U.S. president has sought congressional approval to use military force since President George W. Bush in 2002, ahead of the invasion of Iraq. President Obama wants a three-year commitment. Jerry Corsi, who writes for WND.com and noted author. Jerry, how can we not go in there without a prolonged ground war?
Well, George, there's opposition to President Obama's proposal on both the left and the right. I mean, a three-year commitment may or may not be enough to defeat ISIS. One of the points that was made, I think Charles Krautheimer today on Fox News said if we had a three-year commitment in the Civil War, President Lincoln would have run out of money in 1864 when he faced a major challenge for the presidency from George McClellan, and we may never have finished the Civil War with the Union intact. And this is one of the, and also we've got at WND major breaking news on the Loretta Lynch nomination that we're announcing tonight. It's a HSBC settlement for nearly $2 billion that Loretta Lynch negotiated with nobody going to prison for
amazing
major money laundering scandals that this international bank did with drug dealers in Mexico and Middle Eastern terrorists, and Loretta Lynch brokered the deal that let HSBC employees go scot-free. No criminal prosecutions, just a big fine.
With ISIS, why don't we get everybody to go out to the desert in the Middle East, do a little test, and show them how a nuke explodes, and then say, now stop, because you're next.
Well, George, it certainly would be an emotionally satisfying solution, I think, for those of us who have suffered through the brutality of ISIS, and I doubt that President Obama would be inclined to make such a demonstration. But the point is, if we're going to go after ISIS seriously to defeat them, we're going to have a proposal from the White House that allows Congress to vote the president the necessary military means, including the possibility, which I think everyone hesitates to engage in, of ground troops being redeployed in Iraq to defeat ISIS.
Yeah, ground troops. It's going to have to happen. It's the only way you're going to do it. Jerry, thanks. We'll be in touch. Jerry Corsi writes for WND.com. While Russian military aircraft have stepped up their activities everywhere from the North Sea to the Baltic to the Black Sea in the last year, they have also been spotted now more frequently closer to U.S. territory in the Arctic. So I wonder what's going on there. The captain of the Italian cruise ship, the Costa Concordia, has been found guilty of manslaughter, sentenced to 16 years in prison. The captain was at the helm when the ship hit rocks, sank a couple of years ago, killing 32 people there. In Cape Canaveral, after three scrubs, SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket has successfully fired off from Cape Canaveral. Strong upper-level winds kept the rocket at the launch pad Tuesday evening. Technical issues on Sunday. Poor weather again on Monday pushed back the launch. But it finally made it. prior to the launch, SpaceX said that they would try to land the rocket's first stage back on a barge several hundred miles off the Jacksonville coast. However, they've now announced that they will not attempt it because of rough weather at the sea. Our science advisor and head of the EnterpriseMission.com, Richard C. Hoagland, with us. Richard, this situation here is amazing, but I guess weather's weather, huh?
Well, as the mayor of Boston said about the blizzards they've been having, you know, we've learned you can't fool Mother Nature. Even if you're Elon Musk, you can't fight the weather. And they had seas at that platform around 400 miles off the coast of Florida, three stories high, slashing across that deck of that 300 by 100 meter craft. So it's just a little scow with engines that keep it in place. It's not meant for these kinds of seas. It never was touted as being meant for these seas. So that part of this test that you and I and a lot of other people were all anticipating did not go off as planned. However, we do know from a tweet that Musk sent later, or rather earlier this evening, that the rocket did land, the first stage did land back on the ocean in those winds and those seas. Obviously, it then toppled over when the engines were cut off.
Amazing.
But the the feat this represents, George, we got to do this with a full show and all the implications and bells and whistles. I would suggest around the 27th of this month, because that's the next opportunity.
This is an amazing story, though. There's just so much about privatization, Richard. It's exciting.
It is a transition, as I said on the last show we did, to the second age of space, and Musk, for some reason, is racing at warp 9 to put in place all these incredible advances suddenly in the space of, you know, like a couple, 3 years that we've talked about and listened to and envisioned and dreamed about since the beginning of the first space age, which is 50 years ago.
That
My
is exciting.
My question is, and I want to leave everybody with this tonight, right, until we maybe do this first full show on the 27th or around the 27th. And I want to bring in some other terrestrial applications of these technologies, these breakthrough technologies, like my friend, you know, Charlie Lewis, who has the hydrogen car.
He does.
Well, you know, the half the spaceship is a hydrogen spaceship. And there's affinity there that we need to bring down to Earth so people realize this second age is going to usher in such stunning advances that you and I will live to see things that even this show, if it covers, doesn't cover very seriously because it's just too far out and too phantasmagorical. And I'm seeing the shape of that future in what Musk and his colleagues, the super billionaires who are funding, remember there's a whole asteroid search program now?
Yep.
If Musk succeeds, and he technically has succeeded.
Well, then he will.
Before,
he'll pull this off.
You realize he has done this successfully, right?
Yep.
In the desert, not on a moving platform and not during an operational mission. There might be some folks wondering why. Well, why did he cancel the test if you're going to throw that first stage away anyway? Even if the winds were high and the seas were gigantic, why not try it? And the answer is very simple. He only has two of these drone ships, and if that thing had come down in high winds and had exploded like a bomb,
it's toast.
To the last one,
yeah, that's right.
He would have been out one ship, and there would have been a delay to refurbish or build a new one. So this was careful discretion because he's done it before. Everything worked the last time in January, except for the final few feet because they ran out of the open loop hydraulic fluid. So the next one, which is February 27th, you and I should be front stage for history. We should lay out, with enough time to do it, all the implications, because this really will make it possible for you and me to go to the moon.
Well, that's a possibility. And that I would do, Richard. I'm not going to Mars, but I'd go to the moon. Richard Hoagland, website enterprisemission.com. Allergic to milk, or you know someone who is, a recent study by the Food and Drug Administration has found that 59% of dark chocolate products in the U.S. contain trace amounts of milk. Dark chocolate has long been heralded as a lactose-free way to enjoy delicious chocolate flavor, but the FDA test of more than 100 dark chocolate bars revealed that many of them contained milk, just so you know. President Obama, they're saying the administration has released, of course, 332 pages with a plan to control the internet. Lauren Weinstein with us. He is an expert in the internet. What's this all mean, Lauren?
Well, we're back to politics over science in a lot of this, and unfortunately, in this case, it's the basically the politicians that are under the control of the dominant ISPs like Comcast and Verizon and AT&T. You know, I'm always straight with you, George.
Yes, you are.
And the politics of this don't really interest me very much. What interests me is the internet, because I've spent basically my entire
career, your life,
my whole life, really, one way or another, trying to see that the internet grows and is useful to the most people possible. And to see this current situation where what is basically, from all the information we have right now, is that what the FCC is going to propose is a very basic set of rules that will provide fairness to everybody that wants to use the internet. The alternative is to have what has been voted the most hated company in the United States, Comcast, have almost half of the internet subscribers under their control. And we know historically that the big dominant ISPs don't follow through with what they say they're going to do unless there's a law to force them to do it. That's why we've had so many cities where they promise to build big high-speed internet systems, fiber systems.
And they never do.
Verizon has abandoned theirs now. They're not going to build it out anymore. AT&T isn't spreading their system, their high-speed system anymore. They make the promises, they never build it, and then they've got you over the barrel, because unlike in most other parts of the world where they have higher speeds and lower prices, it's because there was competition. Here, those big companies, these dominant ISPs, have been paying politicians for decades to avoid competition. So my basic advice on the whole FCC Title II situation is, let's wait and see what comes out of it. I think we're going to find that when we actually see all the details and we actually see what's voted on, the people that are saying this is a government takeover are going to have a problem, because what we're going to find out is it's really just a way to have some fairness in what is a critical resource for all of us, and is to prevent a Comcast takeover of the internet. So let's wait and see.
All right, Lauren, thank you so much. Remember that story I had about the Florida cat that crawled out of its grave after a traffic accident? Well, it's now caught in a legal dispute over custody involving its owner and the Humane Society of Tampa Bay. Bart the Cat, nicknamed the Zombie Cat on social media, made international headlines last month when he surfaced 5 days after he was hit by a car and buried for dead. He was initially expected to return home after surgery, but the Humane Society figures, you know what, there's something wrong. We got a little bit more information about the owner and what's been going on. They've decided not to return the cat, and, it's a legal dispute there. Remember the story we had a few weeks ago with Richard Shaw? There is a code in the Torah, the first five books of the Old Testament, and the code is real. It is mathematically provable. I just tossed out to Richard. I said, hey, what if my name's in the Torah? Well, he did some checking, and those results are next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. If you are by your computer or you've got your smartphone, you might want to go to coasttocoastam.com and start looking at the tablets that we have from the Torah that was supplied to us from Richard Shaw. Richard, of course, producer, director, editor of the Torah Codes. And he was with me January 19th as we talked about his work and the Torah Codes. And that's when I tossed out the idea, hey, check and see if I'm in there. And Richard, welcome back. And then you took this information and took it to whom? What happened?
Well, thank you, George. Yes, we did. When you showed an interest in wanting to do this, it was late that evening. It was like in the fourth hour of the show, and a gentleman called in from London, Ontario, and asked the question, could the Torah Codes be the Book of Life? Which I thought was kind of an interesting question, and something that Rabbi Glazerson and I had talked about, because what happened one day, I said, does everybody's name come up in the codes? And he said, there's some names we can't find. And that was kind of startling to me. We started working on your name. Thanks for calling me and giving me your information. And that was sent to Jerusalem and to New York. And the first table that I got back was from researcher Art Levitt. And indeed, he found your name. That's the first table in this at the Pinlight site. And maybe you guys have it up on the Coast to Coast site as well. But it says, in parallel rows, George Norrie, broadcaster. And then crossing your name, it says paranormal. And when I got that, I just, that freaked me out a bit, because that was a word that I didn't expect to see in the Torah codes.
And as we go through some of these tablets in the Torah, you had a number of different people provide their interpretation, did you not?
That's right. They were basically the same group of men that worked with me on the Torah Code film, and this is Art Levitt, who's a researcher, Rabbi Matityahu Glazerson, who's an expert in ancient Hebrew, Dr. Alexander Rotenberg, who's actually a descendant of the Vilna Gaon, a famous mathematician and rabbi that lived in the 17th century, Professor Eliyahu Rips, who's quite famous because of Michael Drosnin's books, but who basically spearheaded the research of the Torah code since the late 70s. And then finally, Professor Robert Herelick from City University in New York. So these guys aren't just hobbyists in their bedroom on their home computers looking up something in the King James Version. These are the real world experts that spent 3 weeks looking your name up and making sure that they got it right. And then we collaborated on each one of these tables via the internet until we got a set that we thought was presentable.
How many tables have we got here?
We've got about 9. And I know we have limited time here this evening, so I can either go through them quickly or if there's...
Yeah, we've got some time before the break, then we'll come back and go through some more of these.
Okay, well, the second one was Rabbi Glazerson's table, which I thought was interesting. He actually found the name Coast to Coast in it.
Just
which
remarkable.
Which is amazing.
It really
and
is.
So I asked him about that, and it's, you know, of course, the name of the show, and he said he found it one time in the entire Torah, and it spanned all 5 books. It had a large skip, but the words Coast to Coast came up. And along with that, what's important to understand is that your name appears near that. Just a few lines away, it says Nori, and crossing your name, it says in the United States. And then at slight angles, we have the word radio and broadcaster, and then your first name, George, is down below at the bottom part of the table. I mean, all of this is in the same table. It's just, it's unbelievable.
It really is strange.
So Art Levitt took that table and worked on it and changed the way that it's represented, so Coast to Coast came up closer together. But when he did that, he discovered that the name Norrie appeared twice in the same line, overlapping each other. That's very unusual. And the word Norrie only appears twice in the whole Torah, as far as I understand from the rabbis and professors that worked on this. So it goes coast to coast, vertically, Norrie, Norrie, intersecting itself, and then also on the same line, sharing one letter, if I remember right, it says in the U.S. And then Dr. Rotenberg came up with a table, and everyone has a different
And they're all working independently at that
they're
time,
they're all working
right?
independently, but we all send this stuff. I mean, we do tons of emails together, and everybody looks at everybody's work. And everyone has a slightly different way of approaching doing it, like Dr. Rotenberg is a graduate of the Moscow University and wrote the software called Soft Torah that most of the rabbis and professors use to search the Torah codes. And he came up with your name again. It's in the same spot as it is on the other tables, but then he found the words in slightly different areas. So this table is a little bit different, but the skips are relatively small. Only 3 letters between each of the characters in the word Nori.
What do you think that, what does that mean, Richard?
Well, normally when there's so few characters between letters in a skip, it helps improve the probability that this isn't just random chance. You know, if you find your name and there's like, you know, 5,600 letters between each letter, then it doesn't really mean all that much. It could be considered insignificant. But when there's only three letters between each letter in your name, as there was in this table, that's really something. But the next one, of course, is Professor Rips. This is on page 2, if people are following along.
Hold
on
right there. We'll come back to page 2, Richard. We're going to have your conclusions once we get through all the tables. And then we'll take some phone calls in the remaining moments we have with you. Richard Shaw talking about Torah codes and why I'm in there. We'll be back. Well, Beyond Belief, that's our television program. Watch it free for a little bit, for some time. Just simply go to the website, beyondbelief.com, and sign up for it. If you haven't done it yet, it's very easy to do. Once you get into the website, it'll show you what you fill out. beyondbelief.com. We'll be back in a moment as we talk more about why I'm in the Torah with Richard Shaw, and we'll take your calls on Coast to Coast AM. Back with Richard Shaw as we look at the Torah. Richard, I believe we're going to part 2 now. Was that correct?
That's correct. Are you on part 2, George?
I'm looking at it. And everybody, if you are at a computer, you just click the highlights reel. It says click here once you get into the Torah. And we're on part 2. You'll see that. It connects you to Richard Shaw's website. Go ahead, Richard.
Now, this is the one that Professor Rips did for you, and he often comes up with complete sentences that he finds using the same skip for every word in the sentence, which is really phenomenal. Professor Rips is a world-class mathematician. I mean, he's at a very high level of understanding, and he came up with something that was just so mind-boggling, and it basically is totally you and your personality. It says, loves the paranormal, but clear-cut.
That's me.
That's you. Crossing that line, it says radio. Then off to the right, it says broadcaster, and off to the left, it says Nori. That's one of my all-time favorite tables that we found. And then finally, on the last page, part 3, these were done by Professor Robert Herlick at City University in New York. He found every single thing pretty much about you, George. It says coast to coast, George Norrie, radio broadcaster in the U.S., your birthday, year, author, and one of your book titles, Journey to Light.
Worker in the Light and Journey to the Light.
That's right. He did a table for each, but the really incredible one, in my opinion, is the small one at the bottom of page 3. It says George Norrie, radio broadcaster in the U.S., all of the words that we used as basically search criteria. But there's a little set of numbers off to the left and right, if you notice, of that table. And it says 4/32.25.
Right, what does that mean? Yeah, what does that mean?
Yeah, I'm going to tell you. At the bottom it says 4/32.33. That means the fourth book of the Torah, which is the book of Numbers, the 32nd chapter, starting with the 25th verse through the 33rd verse. So what this is, when I saw this, I about fell out of my chair, because that means all of these words were found in a space of only a few verses in one chapter of the book of Numbers.
Huh. So what does this all mean to you, Richard? The fact that my name is splattered in the Torah, and it mentions radio, broadcasting, the show. What does this mean?
Well, it means that you were encoded in the Torah some 3,327 years ago, as were almost everyone else in some respect. I'm in the Torah several times. My company name, Pinlight, is in the Torah several times. I can't explain it. I don't know what it means, other than we have the computer systems now that are powerful enough to find this information, and it comes up in a way that doesn't come up in just unencoded text like Moby Dick or War and Peace. These come up in a more sensible way, where we have groups of words or best pairs of words together. So it's just it's phenomenal.
Well, I remember when you first told me, George, you're in it. We're still going through it, and I said, Richard, am I the Antichrist? And you said, no, don't worry about that. It's much bigger than that. You're okay.
Yeah, you're okay. And it's Torah codes aren't there to slander people. And there's nothing about you being assassinated or anything grisly like that, like there was about Yitzhak Rabin.
Right.
And, you know, Michael Drosden's table.
That's amazing. Just yeah. It really is. Let's take some calls here for the time we have remaining, Richard. And you've got a link at pinlight.com as well, don't you?
Yes, I do. It's right on the About page. And if you click on the Nori table button, it'll take you to all of these.
Okay, let's go to the phones. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Richard is with us. Richard, you're on with Richard Shaw. Go ahead.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Richard.
Hi.
Do you have anything in the Bible code that you have found that matches other Bible code professionals and studiers, that matches President Obama with the Antichrist? And I know it's repetitive, but that's what my question was. Thank you.
There are a number of Obama tables. Like I said on the 19th of January, we're dealing with Orthodox rabbis who aren't looking at New Testament variances as far as the word Antichrist is kind of a New Testament phrase. But there are a number of tables about Obama that kind of refer to his Islamic background, putting him kind of in that category. It's not proof of anything, but it says your father Islamic. It says Obama will be elected with the word Islam running through that title. And then another Torah code researcher by the name of Doran Whitstam, who was one of the original Torah code discoverers that worked with Professor Ripps way back in the 80s, discovered a single word code, not in the Torah, but in the book of Ezekiel. I don't know what this means, but the word Obama was found in the 38th chapter of Ezekiel, and most people understand that chapter to be about the current situation that we're dealing with Iran. So it's almost like that particular chapter is time-stamped with the name Obama in it, which I don't have any scientific explanation for it, but it is interesting.
And some of the things that were in the Torah that we talked about during your last visit to the program, Richard, talked about, it said the Hamas wars, Twin Towers, BP oil disaster, the economy. It
sure
spells these out. But you need to go looking for things. Isn't that correct?
Yes, you need to do it. Most of the professors agree that it should be an a priori word search. In other words, all the words are spelled out in advance so that you're not just snooping for whatever happens to show up. And if you find something at random, and then you go, well, okay, now I have permission to look for that word that I just found at random, so you do a whole new table using that word, that's kind of like an approach that some of them take. I know Art Levitt uses that, because they're trying to be very careful just not to come up with nonsense, but to come up with actual meaningful phrases that are actually in there.
Next up, we go to Alabama. Hi, David. Welcome to the program. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, George. It's a great honor to be able to talk to you. And
thank you.
I have a question for your guest there.
Okay.
I'm wondering, for a person who is just Mr. or Mrs. Average, you're not famous, you're not well known, is there any way that such a person, such as myself, could find out if you are indeed in the Torah code and what it says about you? How would you go about that? And is there any particular route or way you would suggest starting off?
Well, it doesn't matter your status in life or anything to whether you're listed in the Torah codes. God is not any respecter of persons. That's what I'm sure the rabbis would say. So normally what you would have to do is this isn't like Googling your name on the internet and up comes your name and up comes like 37 other guys with the same name. You have to do it rather scientifically, where you would need your birth date, where you were born, anything that happened to you during your life that was an unusual event, basic things about your occupation, things that are descriptive words about you, and then you would make a list of all of those. and then you would get the Hebrew equivalent, the modern Hebrew equivalent characters for all of those names, and then you would start on searching. I mean, what we did for George here took about 3.5 weeks.
And we had to give you some specific information.
Exactly. And that's why it's not like this is fun and games or some guy that is a hobbyist in his bedroom and happens to have Torah code search software. These guys are the ones that design the software and know what to look for and know Hebrew really well.
How did you convince them, Richard, to even spend the time to do my name?
Because we're all best friends and we've been working together for a long time. I've known Professor Reps and Rabbi Glazerson for about 7 years, and Glazerson and I have been friends all of that time, and Rips I don't get to see as often because he's in Jerusalem. When he came to New York, I flew to New York to see him, and he's just a great guy, brilliant, humble, one of the most interesting people I've ever met in my life. And when you see the film, you kind of get the idea of why I would say that.
Al's in Toronto, International Line. Al, thanks for calling Coast to Coast. You're on the air with us.
Thank you. I have also found some very interesting hidden things. I found the hidden Jewish genetic link that which is left-handedness, which I know interests you. You hear me?
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Al.
Yes. And I have found the Greek concept that the soul is in the thymus. The Hebrew word for soul is neshama, and neshima actually means a breath. And I have found references to what we would call chakras and kundalini, literally in the Bible, that need to be deciphered.
How'd you do that?
It took me 30 years.
See, that's where computers help, Richard, don't they?
Yes, they do. I mean, I have to ask this gentleman, were you using Torah code search software, or are you talking about some other form of research that you're doing?
Talking about literally finding. I published the left-handedness in the Jerusalem Post 30 years ago.
Wow. And so you did this all by hand, didn't you?
Yeah. I'm talking about literally translating the enigmatic words. And for example, the left-handedness, the Bible says that Benjamites had excessive left-handedness, and we found in modern research in 1970 that Ashkenazic Jews have double the amount of left-handedness of the general public. This is the kind of work that I've been doing.
Okay, well, he didn't have a computer at his disposal, Richard.
That's very interesting because I'm also left-handed.
My daughter's left-handed. My dad was left-handed.
Yeah.
My son is left-handed.
Wow.
Amazing.
That's a rather high probability of people in your family.
Yeah, it is. Let's go to Los Angeles now. Joy's with us. Joy, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Thank you very much for this fantastic and fascinating topic. Maybe you all are Ashkenazis and you don't know it.
Maybe.
Okay, I have two questions, please. My first one is, could you find all these things also when you would ask about George Norrie when he's a child?
Well, like I was saying earlier, you would have to have a set of words asking specific questions, and then you would work on finding those specific words to see if they appear.
Okay.
They may or may not. You know, it just depends.
Sometimes I still am.
I think the fact that we found all these words, including the name of the show, Coast to Coast, is quite profound.
Yeah, that is
that
remarkable.
That I didn't expect.
It's breathtaking. It's absolutely breathtaking. The other question that I have is about the technique somewhat to have an idea. I can understand that it's very, very complex. But these are words that were not... They didn't exist at the time when Torah was written. So how do you find them there?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question, Richard. I'm sure when they wrote the actual Torah, they didn't write Coast to Coast AM knowing it. So do they do it subconsciously? What happens?
Well, we don't know how the Torah was encoded, But we do know that modern Hebrew words appear in the encoded text repeatedly. Like I believe last time, George, you asked me, well, the word airplane, does that show up, or flying machine? Well, actually, the word airplane does show up. So there are modern words that we find in, like, the Hebrew newspaper. How do you spell this particular word? And so there may be more than one spelling for the same word, because that's the way Hebrew is. So they find the word that is the most popularly used one and use that in their searches. And sometimes it's there and sometimes it's not. But more often than not, we find things that we don't expect.
It is remarkable, Richard. And, of course, you put a lot of this in Torah codes, into darkness, as you talk about prophecy, the future. Is there anything there in the Torah that has scared the rabbis and the professors?
Well, originally, yes. And that was because of my question. I think I might have mentioned it last time about the year 2012, which they were unfamiliar with. And they came up with all of these tables that were very dire, until we realized that the Torah codes was echoing pretty much was what was being said in our time period about 2012. And there's a lot of dire things being repeated. And so we've learned that sometimes the Torah codes are echoing what people are talking about, what's printed in newspapers or on the internet, and it just appears in the Torah code the same way. It does not mean it's predicting anything. It's just echoing the zeitgeist of the times. It did scare everybody at first.
Let's go to Arlene in Milwaukee, Wisconsin now. Arlene, let's get you in real fast. Go ahead.
How you doing, George? Yeah.
Good.
The Torah, you know, the book of Daniel talks about there's a book that was sealed until the time of the end. It sounds like this is one of those books. And besides to your lifestyle, George, I believe that I told you once before you were chosen, you know, for such a time as this. You're international. It's like God has given you purpose and destiny. And the principle, The Bible talks about the principal thing is wisdom. And then he says when you get that, you get wisdom and knowledge. So, you know, you have a lot of things in your persona, in your makeup that's predestined. God has specifically ordained you for this hour in your book you were talking about, the light book.
Yeah.
You're informing, you're giving out light, you're letting people know, you are revealing things, George. This is your purpose and your destiny. You were called to the universe for such a time as this, and the Torah is one of the end-time books. It's being enlightened, it's being exposed, it's being revealed, it's being made known. This is our hour. So whatever you have to do, people, do it. Do it. Greatest potential.
Thanks, Arlene. Richard, done. Mention your websites, if you would, please.
Oh, sure. Intodarkness.com and pinlight.com. And I would have to agree with that caller in the respect that I do think that what you're doing is very important work, George. And sometimes we refer to Coast as kind of its own church. It's where people are able to discuss things that they can't discuss in church.
I wonder what my mom will say, who's extremely spiritual, when I tell her about this. She's probably listening right now, Richard, in Detroit, going, oh, what? What's going on?
Well, it's very special to have the man who is considered the discoverer of the Torah codes look up your name and find what he found.
Yeah,
I think is really something.
How did he
feel
about that? Was he amazed or what?
Well, I didn't get to actually speak with Professor Rips, but he wrote me a lot of technical information that we don't have time to go through on the phone. But basically, he put some effort into this, and he's a very dear person. So for him to do this is, I was just amazed, because I didn't really expect him to have the time to do it, and it was just that it came out like this. Was shocking.
Okay, my friend Richard, thank you so much. I'll see you at some upcoming events, and we will be back in a moment as we begin the great vaccine special next.